From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's plenty of blame to go around for the failures related to the American involvement in the war in Vietnam. But that's not what Rory Kennedy's film is about. Her documentary, which premiered at Sundance Film Festival last year and was nominated for an Academy Award, is about those last days in Vietnam as the communist North Vietnamese army advanced towards Saigon and as the remaining Americans and hundreds and thousands of South Vietnamese soldiers and citizens struggled to get out of the country before the army arrived. In those chaotic moments, policy seems irrelevant, and in fact, this is a theme in the film. As one American ship commander puts it, you didn't have time to think about it, you just did it. Today in the program, we're profiling Kennedy's documentary, which is not about geopolitics, but human stories. The last days in Vietnam, after the news.
Well, I'm James Morges. I'm the new general manager of KUED. I guess now after 10 months, I'm probably not so new. And I've been in public broadcasting for, with the exception of a few years in commercial, I've been in public broadcasting my entire life. Doug Fabrizio, Radio West, you talk about a driveway moment. I was out there in the parking lot here just 2 days ago, and he was doing something on a couple that wrote a book on trying to explain Mormonism in a little bit different way, and I'm not LDS, so this was riveting. And he did such a good job, such a good job. He's such an intelligent guy that I tell you what, if I have the time during my workday, I will tune into Radio West and listen to what he does, because he is brilliant at the way he manages content and draws out the important points of a story. Doug reliably, he delivers. And he's really, really good.
It's KUER Spring Fun Drive. If Radio West is important to you, we hope you'll consider a gift to the station. You can become a sustaining member for as little as $10 a month. Go online to KUER.org to make your pledge. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Here's the basic plot for Rory Kennedy's documentary, The Last Days in Vietnam. Almost exactly 40 years ago this month, the North Vietnamese Army was marching toward the South. Their destination was Saigon, the capital of the South Vietnamese Army and the American Embassy. The North Vietnamese had violated the Paris Peace Accords, and when everyone realized their army would be there in days, not months, chaos began. American troops were mostly gone by then, but there were still thousands of American foreign office workers, CIA operatives, contractors, not to mention their families. And of course, there were hundreds of thousands of South Vietnamese citizens who had helped the Americans in the war effort, whose lives were very much in danger if they stayed. But Rory Kennedy's film is not about geopolitics. It's not about flawed foreign policy. Really, it's best expressed by the journalist and former CIA analyst Frank Snepp, who witnessed those last days in Vietnam. In the film, he reflects back on what he had learned once the dust had cleared.
I have wrestled with this ever since. I realized that I had become the quintessential American in Vietnam.
And really, that's what Rory Kennedy's film is about, the lives affected by this moment in the war and the incredibly dramatic stories that played out. Today in the program, we're talking about Rory Kennedy's documentary, Last Days in Vietnam. You can join us if you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Rory Kennedy is with us through the hour. Her films include Ghosts of Abu Ghraib and Ethel. It's a documentary portrait of her mother, Ethel Kennedy. She's joining us today from a studio on the campus of Pepperdine University in Malibu, California. And Rory Kennedy, welcome back to you. Thanks for being with us.
It's great to be here again, Doug. Thanks for having me.
We also have Kevin McAllister with us, who helped produce and write Last Days in Vietnam. He's joining us from a studio in Los Angeles. And Kevin McAllister, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Doug. Thanks so much for having me.
You can see Last Days in Vietnam on Friday evening. The Utah Film Center and KUER sister station, KUED, is screening the film. Rory Kennedy will be there along with two of the film's subjects for a Q&A. We'll give you more details about that as we go along. So Rory Kennedy, you know, I wanted to begin with Stuart Harrington. I mean, there's a lot of great characters in this film, but I kind of want to start with him. I think on some level, it's almost like he's the heart of the film. The first important character we meet. Tell us about former Army Captain Stuart Harrington.
Well, Stuart Harrington plays a really important role both in the evacuation that took place in April of 1975 in Saigon, as well as in our film. I think he's really a central character. As you know, having watched the film, there's no narrator in the film. There are no historians who are looking back. But I think if there was a narrator, it would really be Stu Harrington. He kind of takes us through the story of what happened from the beginning to the end. And part of the reason for that is that he was right there. He was at the embassy. He really experienced the chaos of what happened firsthand. And like so many other Americans and South Vietnamese at the time, he took matters into his own hands, and he decided that he was going to do everything he could to save as many South Vietnamese as possible. And he initiated what was really an operation that was – they're called Black Ops. They were under the radar of the ambassador, under the radar of the U.S. government, in an attempt to try to get as many Vietnamese out as possible. At that time, the ambassador in April of 1975, when it was pretty clear to so many that the North was going to come in and take over, he was resistant and refused to greenlight an evacuation. And so people like Stuart Harrington decided they were going to do what they needed to do to get their fellow citizens from South Vietnam out of the country, knowing that if they didn't, they would face very serious consequences.
Let me play another clip from the film. This is actually one of the there's so many. I have to say, it's every story is dramatic, every story is gripping. Like, there's not a moment in this event that doesn't seem to go down to the wire. It's really amazing. And one of the first ones we encounter early on in the film is Captain Harrington, who's sort of breaking protocol here. And he goes out, borrows a truck to collect some South Vietnamese people, and he wants to get them on a plane. Here's a moment from the film Last Days in Vietnam.
I had told them, when you hear three thumps, that means hold the baby's mouths, don't breathe, don't talk, don't make any noise, because we're going through the gatepost. I saluted in uniform as a captain of the United States Army. The guard waved me through, and I drove straight out to the flight line to an aircraft that was awaiting. One Vietnamese colonel that was putting his family on the plane, he had wanted to stay in Vietnam to defend the country. And this full colonel had like 8 kids and a wife. And he was in tears, the family. The family were in tears. And I said to him, get on the plane. Just go. Go. It was a terrible, terrible, terrible moral dilemma for everybody.
Rory, do you think that kind of encapsulates what the film's about? That it was a moral dilemma for everybody?
I think that is really the essence of the film. You know, these were the folks who were on the front lines. You really have a sense in watching the film that there's U.S. policy, there's the wave of history moving against them, there's this huge tide that is going in a particular direction. And this handful of people, both Americans and South Vietnamese, who were right there on the front lines, stood up and they did what was right. And I think, you know, one of the things that excited me about this story is that when we think about Vietnam in this country, I think we really, you know, there's not much that is positive that comes out of that war or is associated with that war. And it was exciting to me to uncover some of these stories, which I certainly didn't know, and be able to share them with folks and with audiences now across the country, starting in Utah a year ago at the Sundance Film Festival. Yeah. And, you know, it's really, I think, stunning for most audiences to see these extraordinary acts of courage. People who certainly risk their jobs and arguably risk their lives to save as many people as possible. And, you know, I think the film takes a very focused look at all of, you know, the problems and the disaster of the war and the overall abandonment during those final days of, you know, American to our Vietnamese allies. But it also highlights these extraordinary people who did extraordinary things.
You were approached by, I think it was Mark Samuels of the American Experience early on about maybe doing this story. Did you know that that's what you wanted to do? That it wouldn't be, it would be critical of some of the policy things that had happened, certainly critical broadly about Americans abandoning some of the South Vietnamese. But did you know that you didn't want it to be a political film, that you wanted it to be mostly just a collection of stories?
I think we were very much aware that the geopolitical documentaries about Vietnam had been made before. And one of the great things about Rory's films is they're always about human beings. They're always about the people affected by policy and by history. And so once we started reading books, Stuart Harrington had written a book, Frank Snepp had written a book about the fall of Saigon. Once we'd read those and kind of gotten a little more familiar with the history, it was clear that the human stories of the people on the ground are what we wanted to make the film about.
So here's another piece of context to sort of help understand what's going on. I mean, the Paris Peace Accord, of course, gave people some real hope that the war, gosh, maybe the war is actually over and the South and the North now could coexist. If not peacefully, maybe they could, you know, coexist at least in some way. But then it turns out this peace accord, as you tell in the film, is fragile. It's this masterpiece of ambiguity, as Frank Snepp puts it. And it's so interesting how dependent it was, almost amazingly, on the persona of Richard Nixon and the promises that he had made that if things went badly, he'd bring American troops back in. Let me play another clip here because I want you to talk about the presence or the influence of Richard Nixon being there and not being there. Here's Frank Snepp, CIA analyst again, in Rory Kennedy's film, Last Days in Vietnam.
The North Vietnamese viewed Nixon as a madman. They were terrified of him. They believed that Nixon, if necessary, would bring back American air power. But in August 1974, he was gone. Nixon resigned because of Watergate. And overnight, everything changed. Hanoi suddenly saw the road to Saigon as being open.
Rory Kennedy, talk a little bit about how things change really at this moment with Nixon out of the way.
Well, you know, I think the general consensus is that the North was going to come in no matter what, and that was their intention. But I think that they came in at that particular moment because they saw some vulnerability on the part of the United States and therefore the part of South Vietnam. As you established early on in the program, the American troops had already left with the Paris Peace Accord. When the North came in at that time, they thought it would take 2 years to get to Saigon. But they came in through the northern part of South Vietnam at the border of North Vietnam, and the country fell like a house of cards. And they were able to get to Saigon within 4 months, which is in part why we were taken off guard. We didn't really have a evacuation plan in place. There was denial as well for the people on the front lines, particularly the ambassador. And that led to the chaos that took place during those final hours. And, you know, I think a lot of the audience here is probably familiar with the image of the helicopter on top of what we think is the embassy. It wasn't, in fact, the embassy. It was a CIA outpost. And how we ended up having to evacuate people pretty haphazardly from the top of the embassy ultimately to try to get as many people out on helicopters.
Yeah. Kevin McAllister, the South Vietnamese citizens, many of them were worried about what would happen when the North Vietnamese Army finally did, you know, ride into town. And there were stories of reprisals and brutality by the North. What were the stakes for the South Vietnamese who had helped the Americans in the war effort, who had fought in the South Vietnamese Army?
Well, I think the fear on the part of the South Vietnamese was rooted in many things. There had been, when the country was bisected originally in 1954, there had been purges of Catholics from the North, and there had been a mass exodus to the South. And again, during the war, there's a famous example during the Tet Offensive where the North Vietnamese took the city of Hue and rounded up teachers and sort of civil servants and had mass executions. As Stuart Harrington notes in the film, some cases they were buried alive. So there was this fear of what the culture of communism would visit upon a country that had basically been a capitalist Western sort of leaning society. And I think that in many cases ended up being true. There weren't the mass executions that were predicted before the fall of Saigon, but there were hundreds of thousands, up to a million people sent to so-called re-education camps, which were essentially hard labor concentration camps, the worst of which were incredibly brutal and many people died. So there was this danger of sort of ideological imprisonment after the war, if not execution.
Let me play another moment from the film. The North Vietnamese Army is really rapidly heading south, approaching the central Vietnamese city of Da Nang, and refugees are streaming out of that country. And in one of these really dramatic scenes from the film, people are clamoring to get aboard this airplane to escape. In this clip, Roy, we're hearing a reporter explaining what he's seeing. Is that what we're hearing?
That's correct.
Our plane is surrounded here. I don't know how the hell we're going to get out. We're racing down the runway, leaving behind hundreds and thousands of people. Another dozen are there, running along, grabbing at the air stair. We're pulling them on as fast as we can. There's a sea of humanity jamming on. Impossible to stop the crowd. We're pulling away. We're leaving them behind. We're pulling up with the... People are falling off the air stairs. The plane is taking off.
It was... Every man for himself.
So explain what Americans know at this point in the story. I mean, you show in the film news reports, Walter Cronkite, Dan Rather, and others, you know, reporting on the advance of the communist army. So we're all watching the communists advancing. But what's going on in America? Because we are sort of like today, we're a people who are war weary. And really skeptical about doing any fighting anymore, I guess.
Well, I think you pinpointed it exactly. Obviously, Americans saw the news of what was going on in South Vietnam and saw that the army was advancing towards Saigon. But there was this suspicion, certainly among Congress, members of Congress, that... any requests for aid were an attempt to draw us back into the conflict. So on April 10th, 1975, President Ford went before Congress and asked for $722 million to help South Vietnam stave off defeat. But there was also in the package that he asked for, there was permission to effect an evacuation and the money for an evacuation effort, which ultimately ended up being defeated. So that really caused problems for the people on the ground in Saigon as to how to effect an evacuation, which they were now understanding would need to take place in weeks, if not days.
But I would argue that at that point in April of 1975, there were very few good options available to the U.S. government. You know, short of us sending troops back and re-entering the war, which was just not going to happen. It wasn't politically viable. We weren't there as a country or as Congress, and it was not going to happen. And so even if this aid package had been approved, I think it would have made things better, for sure, and hopefully contributed to a more methodical evacuation effort. But I don't think it would have really stemmed the tide of history and the events that took place and how they played out in any significant way.
Maybe this is an obvious question, but and there are clear differences, of course, between what was happening in those last days of the American experience in Vietnam and what is happening in, you know, Iraq today or Afghanistan. I mean, circumstances are different. The technology is different. But it seems there are a lot of similarities here. And I wanted you to both maybe talk a little bit about that. I mean, you have a country, as I mentioned, weary of war, maybe unwilling to commit troops and power to protect the people who have been left behind, who helped the American war effort then and now. You know, native troops who lack a real commitment to fight. I mean, there are a lot of parallels.
Absolutely. And I think that was certainly one of the things that drew me to this story. And I've always been fascinated by Vietnam, but I felt that it was actually, even though this is an event that took place 40 years ago this April, that it was, in fact, very timely. And a lot of the challenges and struggles that we're dealing with today as a nation, I think, are reflected in what happened during those final days and certainly echoed in those events. And I think you're touching on some of them, but I would say that, you know, this question of what happens to the people on the ground who are left behind, I think, is a significant one. I think ultimately the film is a reminder of the human cost of war. And I think in the debates about Iraq and Afghanistan and ISIS, that sometimes we lose the focus on that and we get mired in policy and the economics and other issues, but we kind of lose track of what happens to the human beings, both who are in country, as well as, of course, you know, our soldiers and what happens to them. And I think it's a hugely important issue that we need to really come to terms with as a nation. I think, as I mentioned earlier, that, you know, my sense is by April of 75, there were very few good options available. So one of the lessons I learned in making this film is that you really need to make strategic decisions before you enter a war and really have a sense of what the exit strategy is. That once you enter these engagements, you can lose control, as we did in Vietnam. And that's important to consider as we're deepening our reach in other places around the world and to really understand what the long-term implications are. And I think this moment in history is a valuable reminder of that.
Let's say something before we head to a break about the ambassador in Saigon at the time, Graham Martin. He's a remarkably complicated guy, and I really like the way you portray him. I mean, you would get a sense early on that he was going to be kind of the bad guy, but he isn't. He's more complicated than that. Tell us a little bit about him. He is fancies himself a bit of a gentleman, and he's also deeply personally invested in this war.
That's right. He was a career diplomat. He was sent to Saigon in, I believe, 1973, after the Paris Peace Accords were signed. And he had an adopted son who had been killed in combat in the Vietnam War. So by all accounts, this is Graham Martin, he died in 1991, so he's not interviewed in the film, which we made us more careful to make sure that we understood exactly what his motives were and what happened. But by all accounts, he didn't believe that South Vietnam would fall as quickly as it did. Part of that was the need to sort of keep up this public face, that there was still hope. But I think also, I think he underestimated the prospects for the South Vietnamese government, for South Vietnamese military, and perhaps underestimated some of the intelligence that he was getting. But once he saw that defeat was inevitable, he quickly turned and tried to drag out the evacuation as long as he could in order to save as many South Vietnamese as he could in the final 24 hours.
That was, I have to say, that was kind of one of the themes I gathered from all of this is that, and I kind of mentioned this, Rory Kennedy, in the introduction, that this isn't really a film that does a lot of blaming. I mean, there's plenty of blame to go around, but it was more complicated. People like this commander, this ship commander, Paul Jacobs, said you didn't have time to think, you just had to act. And in many ways, that's what the film is about, is people just reacting and acting at the moment.
I think that's right. And I think that, you know, it paints a complex picture of the role of Congress, the role of Washington, Kissinger, the South Vietnamese, the North Vietnamese. There's plenty of blame to go all around. And I think, you know, my hope with this film is to create a story of what happened primarily during those last 24 hours of the war from the perspective of the people who were there, the people who were living it, the people who were on the front lines. It almost exclusively takes place in Saigon. We jump back and forth to Washington, but as I said, there's no narrator in the film. There are no historians. The film really plays out, you know, people say like a thriller of what's going to happen next. As the characters make decisions, you as the audience don't know anything more than they know at that moment. Of course, we all know that we didn't win the war, but aside from that, the actual events and the implications to their individual lives. And so you're seeing people respond in this moment of crisis and what they do in that circumstance. And in that sense, I think it is a film not just about war, but about human nature and what we do to look out for each other and to protect each other. And I think, you know, it's part of the reason why the film has touched a nerve. And, you know, initially we were going to go out to 3 theaters across the country. It went to over 125 theaters. It was nominated for an Academy Award. I think it's because of that humanity and that kind of transcendent quality of understanding how people act in pretty extraordinary circumstances.
Rory Kennedy is with us. She directed the documentary film Last Days in Vietnam. Kevin McAllister also with us. He helped write and produce the film. This Friday evening, the Utah Film Center and KUED, they're screening the film at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. Rory Kennedy is going to be there for a Q&A after the film. She's going to be joined by retired U.S. Army Colonel Stuart Harrington, artist Bin Phu, who escaped from Vietnam in 1978. He's featured in the film. We'll talk about that when we get back from a break. KUER's news director Terry Gilday is hosting that conversation on Friday. If you can't make it, by the way, to that screening, the PBS series American Experience is showing Last Days in Vietnam on April 28th. We'll have details about all of that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the documentary film Last Days in Vietnam. There's going to be a screening, free screening, by the way, of the film on Friday at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. It's giving us a chance to talk about it. We have with us today on the program Rory Kennedy, who directed and produced the film. Kevin McAllister also with us. He helped produce and write the film. We'll give you the details, by the way, about the screening a little bit later on the program. So, Rory Kennedy and Kevin McAllister, let's talk about the USS Kirk. There were a lot of ships standing by in the South China Sea waiting for this evacuation of South Vietnamese citizens and Americans. But the USS Kirk plays a remarkable role. And you show this wide shot of the Kirk, which makes you realize it's really not that big. A ship. It had one little helipad, which is sort of part of the story.
Yeah. So the USS Kirk ended up playing a very significant role in the evacuation, and also an unexpected role. What was happening, just to orient the audience, is there was a fleet of U.S. ships in the South China Sea. Those fleets had helicopters on them. The helicopters would go from the fleet to the embassy, pick people up at the embassy, bring them back to the fleet. This was going on throughout the day of April 29th, trying to get as many people out as possible. The USS Kirk was a ship that was closer to the shore and was monitoring in case the North came in or anybody came in to attack the fleet. And it was meant to protect the fleet. What ended up happening is that the South Vietnamese Air Force had basically disintegrated at that point, but there were still pilots there, and they still had access to the helicopter. Somebody described it like the Old West, and instead of people jumping on their horses, they jumped on these helicopters, and they started chasing the American helicopters who were heading out to the fleet. But many of these smaller helicopters that were then piloted by the South Vietnamese and that were filled to the brim with family members and friends and colleagues didn't have enough gas to make it all the way out to the fleet. And the first ship that they came to was the USS Kirk.
Yeah.
The USS Kirk is there and is looking at these blips on the radar, having no idea who it was. Is it enemy? What is it? And these helicopters start hovering above the Kirk. And they say to the captain, the sailors say, what do we do? And the captain says, well, let's call the first one down and see what's going on here. The first QE comes down and 13 people come out of this helicopter that's made for four people.
Yeah.
They're all South Vietnamese, and they're so grateful because, you know, they're heading out to sea and they have no idea where they're going to land or where they're going to go, but they figure it's better than staying behind. I mean, it's such an extraordinary moment and an act of courage on the part of the South Vietnamese. But then there's, as you comment, the Kirk is small. So there's not enough room for another helicopter, and it's not meant for helicopters. So then – but there are all these other helicopters hovering above. The sailors say to the captain, Captain Jacobs, what do we do? And he says, throw that helicopter overboard. Let's make room for the next one.
Right.
And we have this extraordinary footage of these sailors pushing the helicopters over the Kirk. And, you know, the next helicopter comes down and the next one after that and after that. And, you know, they ended up taking on this mission of saving Vietnamese. And, again, they didn't get approval from Washington. Nobody called and said, is this okay? They just decided, you know, they were going to do the right thing.
I want to talk about another element of this story, which is another really dramatic, incredibly dramatic moment. And it's told by, is it Mickey Nguyen?
Yes.
Mickey Nguyen is 6 years old at this time. His father is this incredibly talented, it turns out, helicopter pilot. And he's happened to, he's managed to get a Chinook helicopter. These are really big. And he goes and picks up his family. He lands in this playing field, soccer field or something nearby, and picks up his family to head to sea to see if they can find a ship that that will take them. Let me play a clip. This is Mickey Nguyen from the film Last Days in Vietnam.
My dad is afraid for not having enough fuel. Afraid for a lot of things. He was just flying blind. And then he saw a ship out there.
So I play that little moment to sort of set up this story, if you would. Roy, tell us what happens, because it's amazing.
It is an extraordinary moment, I think. So they head out to sea, and they come up. They come to the Kirk, the USS Kirk, once again. And they're then hovering over the Kirk in this gigantic Chinook helicopter. I mean, these things, you know, they're the double prop helicopters. They hold 50 people in them. And the sailors of the Kirk wave the captain of the Chinook away and say, you can't land here because it will destroy the ship. It will absolutely destroy the ship and it will destroy the helicopter. There's no question. When you see pictures of both of them, you can see why. And the captain of the pilot, Mickey's father, radios down and says, I'm running out of gas. I have no choice. And so what he does in that moment is an extraordinary thing, which is that he hovers over the USS Kirk. They say he's probably 16 to 18 feet above the Kirk because there's sort of a pole in the middle of the Kirk that prevents him from getting any closer. The Kirk, now you have to know, is moving probably 7 knots through the sea.
Right.
He opens the door of the helicopter and he has his 8-month-old baby, his 2-year-old, 5-year-old, 10-year-old, 15-year-old, all of his children, his wife, other family members on this helicopter. He opens the door and proceeds to throw the children out of the helicopter. And the sailors on the Kirk look up and they see these things coming out and they you know, put their arms out and they catch the baby, they catch the 2-year-old, they catch all the children, each and every one of the people who jumped out. It's an extraordinary thing. And then they all jump out and then, of course, the pilot – is still in this gigantic Chinook and can't jump out himself.
Can I play a clip at this point?
Yes, please.
This is so great. This is Hugh. You'll hear the voice of Hugh Doyle here, who was chief engineer on the USS Kirk, telling this story. All right, now keep in mind what Rory has said. So he's gotten rid of his family. He's alone in the Chinook, running out of fuel. Hugh Doyle takes it from there.
Then the pilot flew out on our starboard right side. He hovered with his wheels in and out of the water. He hovered there for like 10 minutes, and we couldn't figure out what he was doing, and it turned out what he was doing was taking his flight suit off. And here's a man flying a twin rotor helicopter by himself at the same time he's taking off a flight suit. How you do it, I've talked to helicopter pilots and they can't figure out how he did that. You know, like a Houdini trying to get out of this thing. And finally, he made the helicopter roll to the right as he stepped out the door on the left.
Just thunderous, loud noise. The shrapnel is just blowing up. Suddenly, just quiet. And he pops up, and he's alive.
And he swam away. And the helicopter was only about 20 feet from him when it hit the water. It was amazing.
That's such a great moment. That was Mickey Nguyen, by the way, his son, talking about that moment. There's an interesting little moment here, too, that you mention in the film. He had with him some gold bars, which basically represented all of his life savings, and they went to the bottom of the ocean. He went out alive, but he didn't have came out alive, but he didn't. He had lost everything, as a lot of people had.
Well, that, you know, I think is a significant theme of the film. You know, particularly at the end where you see all of these ships that are overcrowded with Vietnamese, of people who have managed to get out of the country. And you know, where there are ships that are meant for 200 people that have 2,000 people, and they have the shirts on their back, and they've lost their country. They've lost often contact with their family, with their friends. They're going. They don't even know where they're going. They don't speak the language of where they're going. I mean, it's such an extraordinary moment of complete and total loss. And, you know, you see it in that moment with that helicopter pilot and his family. But it's a theme that runs throughout the film, and I think it's really the heart of the film and what is at stake. And, again, it comes back to these human lives. And you know, one of the just most meaningful and poignant things for me, having made this film, is sharing it with the audiences over the course of the last year, and particularly with members of the Vietnamese community here in America, who, for many of them, it's the first time they are revisiting this story. Mm-hmm. And, you know, each and every one has an extraordinary story to tell because either they or their parents came over at this moment in history, you know, and it's they didn't have anything, you know, and they come to this country and they've made so much and they've contributed so much. And I'm so grateful to be coming back to Utah, where this film really, you know, had its beginning, because Utah in particular has been extraordinarily supportive. David and Naja Lockwood, and, you know, with Zions Bank, Scott Anderson, and we're so excited to have the screening on Friday night, which, as you say, is free to the public, and to have people from the film there. Bin Pho and Stu Harrington. I was just with them last night. They're so wonderful to be with and such an inspiration. And I really encourage people to come because it's an experience that you'll never forget.
I think we have time for one more clip. And you mentioned Stu Harrington and Bin Pho. And one of the stories you tell are the 420 South Vietnamese who were left behind. I mean, there were thousands left behind, tens of thousands. But this calculation, which you get into in the film, Kissinger and the White House, they make this calculation. They figure there were 420 people left. But the president says, we can't get everybody. He finally orders the ambassador to get on board one of these helicopters. Stuart Harrington tells this story of he had promised that no one would be left behind, but he has to get on a helicopter and fly away. And here he is reflecting on that experience in the film.
I thought about how this really, really was wrong. I thought maybe I should just say, I'm not leaving till they go, because I promised them. Then I said, don't be a fool. Maybe they've started shooting down helicopters for all you know. You're not going to get anybody else out. It's a presidential order. This decision has been made. So I got to the roof and a CH-46 alighted on the rooftop. Put its ramp down and we got on board. As it took off, the door was open. And down in the parking lot, I could see the group of 420 of them. They were right where we had left them marshaled on this little patch of grass. I felt absolutely awful. It was just so serious and deep a betrayal.
Bin Pho was on that patch of grass. He'd been left behind. But you say that he... In fact, it's a great story. He forgave Stuart Harrington. Rory, you want to end with that story finally?
Well, yeah, it was really wonderful when, and it is a moment I will never forget, when we were at the premiere at Sundance last year, and a number of the people from the film came to Sundance, including Stu Harrington and Bin Pho. And they all came up on stage, and it was the first time any of them had seen the film, so it was a very emotional moment, and they were all, you know, pretty teary having watched this story for the first time. And Stu Harrington was asked a question about having left the 420 people behind, and he was very teary and talking about how throughout his life he lived in fear of running into one of these 420 people. And, you know, and then, of course, there's Bin Pho on stage with him, which is one of the 420 people he left. And Bin grabbed the microphone from him and said, Stu, I want you to know I forgive you. And he told this wonderful story about what happened to him after he had been left behind. And anyway, it was really beautiful, and there wasn't a dry eye in the house. And I'll just add a little footnote to that, which was when the film was nominated for an Academy Award, I extended an invitation to both Ben Foe and Stu Harrington to join us at the Academy. And when I called Stu, Ben Foe, to tell him, I said, Stu Harrington's going to come and other crew people are coming. And Ben was very excited, and then he paused and he said, you know, who would have thought 40 years ago that the guy who had left me behind at the embassy, we'd be going down the red carpet together at the Academy Awards. So you never know in life, right?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. That's a great
story. So listen, they're going to be, the two of them, and they're just fantastic, are going to be at the theater on Friday night. And so I really do encourage folks to come if you are free that night. It's a free screening, and it's really, and it's going to be exceptional. And we've got some really wonderful people who are coming and supporting us, and including Senator Hatch and the governor is going to be there, and LDS Church, and so many folks from Utah who have supported this film from the beginning. And so I hope that folks come. And I want to just add one other thing, which is, this is the thing that I love about NPR and about radio, is that you all are so engaged in the community, and you don't just do shows that people listen to passively, but you are active, you're proactive, you get behind projects like this, and you help me, you help us tell these stories. I love NPR. I love what you all are doing, and I encourage people to support you as well.
Hey, that sounded like a fun drive pitch. Good yeah. Job, Rory Kennedy.
Thank you.
Rory Kennedy, she directed the documentary film Last Days in Vietnam. Kevin McAllister's there too, helped write and produce the documentary film. Thank you to you both very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
It was a pleasure to be here.
As Rory mentioned, Friday evening, Utah Film Center, KUED, they're screening the film at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. As she mentioned, Ben Foe will be there, Stuart Harrington will be there, Rory will be there, Terry Gilday is going to host that conversation, and we'll have all the particulars on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.